Caitlin, we need to have a meeting about meetings.
This sounds terrible. Do we?
And we need to record a podcast about podcasting.
This is getting very meta.
Next up, praying about praying.
I mean, I've been doing that my whole life. I grew up evangelical, and I'm never sure I'm praying right.
Yeah, the Catholics really have us beat there with their rosaries.
Seriously, where's the Hail Mary when you need one?
From Religion News Service, this is Saved by the City, a podcast from two Christian women living in the city of cities, New York. I'm Roxy Stone.
And I'm Caitlin Beatty.
I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. This week on The State of Belief, Jim Wallis, founder of Sojourners and author of the new book, The False White Gospel, Rejecting Christian Nationalism, Reclaiming True Faith, and Refounding Democracy.
It's a culmination, summation of the work that a lot of us have done for an awful long time. I think the time has come for a serious test of faith.
The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet. Distributed by Religion News Service Podcasts and available on your favorite podcast app. I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. The State of Belief is a weekly podcast with a potent mix of spiritual wisdom, political strategy, and hopeful commentary. In a series of inspiring conversations, celebrating our diversity, and bringing us together to, in the words of the great James Baldwin, achieve our country. The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet. Distributed by Religion News Service Podcasts and available on your favorite podcast app.
Speaking of Catholics, they have been doing this thing called the Synod on Synodality.
Sounds very sexy. Lots of sibilant sounds.
Yeah, I mean, I'll admit it kind of sounds like a big yawn. And it is literally a meeting about meeting. It is actually cooler than it sounds. It's been a passion project of Pope Francis for the last 3 years, and at RNS we've been covering it as it's unfolded.
Okay, so the Synod on Synodality, like, explain it to me like I'm five, or like a reader of Religion News Service. I'm a Protestant. I don't know what synodality even means. So what's going on here?
Yeah, so 3 years ago I also had no clue. And I'm still not exactly a Vatican insider, unlike our guest later today, who is.
When you say Vatican insider, is she allowed into the Vatican?
As a reporter. Yeah. She goes into the Vatican all the time.
Whoa. That's so cool.
Yeah. That's her beat.
I just think of the Vatican as this very secretive, closed up. I mean, speaking like an evangelical Protestant and an American.
I think it's a little bit like the White House. Like, there's a lot of press conferences and stuff. There's a whole machine that's like geared toward Vatican news.
Right, right. What specifically has been happening in the last 3 years?
So to begin with, like, churches all across the world were supposed to get their people together, like the local Catholic lay people. And within the church to basically say, like, this is what we like and this is what we don't like. This is what we want the church to address. This is what we want to change. So like a council, like a city council meeting, but for the Catholic Church. So people had those discussions at the very local level, and then it would like go up a notch. Representatives from those churches would go to a bigger meeting with like states or continents, countries. And then eventually, like after discussions at every level, they gathered at the Vatican last October and brought the reports from all of these conversations. And then representatives that, for the most part, like the Pope named, it's obviously all the like cardinals. But then a lot of lay people, including a lot of women, came to the Synod on Synodality. And it was like a big discussion in October. And then there's another one scheduled for next October.
So there were all these local and regional gatherings, and then the leaders of those gatherings came to the Synod to kind of report, like, here's what people that we met with, here are their concerns, here are their viewpoints. And you mentioned women. We're both interested in anything related to women in the church. And so was it significant that there were so many women at this Synod on Synodality? Was that new? Was it like the number of women was significant?
Yeah. both. I mean, I think women have been at synods before, but I think there were more, and I think they were given more authority or more voice. Also, members of, like, people who were representing LGBTQ issues within the Catholic Church. So Father James Martin was there. And so a lot of the conversations that came out of these discussions really centered around kind of hot button issues. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people at these various levels of the Catholic Church brought up, like, LGBTQ inclusion, blessing same-sex marriage, climate change was something that came up a lot, especially in certain parts of the world, whether or not priests can get married.
Oh, wait, this is on the table?
Well, I mean, people brought it to the table. I don't know if it's on the table, but it got brought to the table.
I know the celibacy requirement for Catholic priests has been a point of conversation and contention for a while. Mm-hmm. But I kind of assumed, like, this is a settled thing. This has been in place for, I don't know, 800 years or something.
I think that's a big part of what a lot of people are just wondering about with the synod on synodality is, like, are any of these things really going to change? Mm. Are priests actually ever going to be allowed to get married? Mm-hmm. Is the church really ever going to marry gay couples? And then is the church ever really going to ordain women to the diaconate or ultimately to the priesthood? Like, is that really ever going to happen? Or is this just a lot of talk? Like,
it seems like there's this live question of whether this listening would actually affect real change, not just in terms of attitudes or beliefs, but would this actually affect institutional change for this massive global body? Is the Pope and other top leaders, are they listening with the intent to actually change things, or is it just the appearance of listening while they are just going to do what they were going to do anyway?
Yeah, I mean, you have voiced the concern of many. You got there very quickly, Caitlin. Gold stars.
Yes.
Especially for a Protestant, you know.
No, I'm just cynical. So that's where that's coming from.
So that's been a big, big concern for a large part of the Catholic Church has been that, is this really just a show? Listening for the sake of saying you listened.
Yeah.
And that's been, you know, especially true for people who are maybe more on the progressive side or who maybe have, like, a real stake in this, like gay couples or women who have been, you know, in active service of the church and would like to have that acknowledged in some way or would like to have a leadership role. But then you have a lot of more conservative critics. Pope Francis is beloved by some and not beloved by others. Particularly, there's, like, a lot of, on the more far right, really conservative side, there's a lot of pushback against Pope Francis. A lot of people who want to go back to, like, a Catholicism of, like, before the Second Vatican Council, like, bringing back the Latin Mass, like, so many things like this.
Old school.
Yeah. And they see Pope Francis as a liberal pope, as someone who is making changes too fast or, you know, and they see this synod as, like, as hearing too many voices, you know, in a church that's supposed to be hierarchical. Even the fact that these conversations are being had about LGBTQ issues within the church, about women's ordination, about the possibility of married priests, it's like, why are we even talking about this? And that's just a sign that the liberal agenda has entered the papacy, you know?
Even though I'm sure the true progressives are like, are you kidding me?
Exactly. Exactly. And so at the end of the day, like, a lot of people who want that change, they're certainly not saying, oh, this is a liberal pope.
Right. It's kind of refreshing to be reminded that all of the hot button issues that have, you know, divided and split several Protestant denominations are also showing up at the doorstep of the Vatican. I think it's easy from the outside to think these issues are splitting Christian communities because no one's in charge or we don't have the same kind of hierarchical structures. They have it all figured out on the Catholic side because they have a pope and everybody at the end of the day is going to defer to him. Evangelicals have all these self-identified popes, so no wonder there's all this division and confusion. So even this very hierarchical, slow-moving church, these big cultural flashpoint issues are coming for that church and potentially changing it in pretty significant ways.
Part of the reason that there's these big conversations about whether or not to ordain women and whether or not to allow priests to marry is because they don't have enough priests. You know, there's like parts of the world where priests have to like travel all over to administer mass because there's not a local priest. So they're like, maybe women should be able to serve the Eucharist, or maybe married men should be able to. You know, some of these are live questions.
Almost more pragmatic.
Yeah, more pragmatic in a way.
Okay, so you've convinced me that the synod and synodality is actually quite explosive. And we're going to talk more about its significance, especially for women in the Catholic Church.
Yes, and that's why we wanted to have our guest on today, RNS reporter Claire Jean-Gravet, who is our Vatican insider. She reports from Rome and has been following the synod for 3 years.
Our interview with Claire is coming up later in the show.
But first, a little segment I like to call Popcorn with the Pope.
I hope there is actually popcorn.
There's not. I called it that because we're going to do it popcorn style, you know, like popcorn prayer.
Yep. And we're tracking youth group. It's the type of prayer we did.
The true form of evangelical prayer.
Yeah, that's our rosary.
Yep. All right. So some Pope trivia popcorn style. I'll go first. The Pope has been depicted in many, many movies, but only one time by a woman. Johanna, I don't actually know how to say her last name, Johanna Wachalek.
That sounds right.
In the movie Pope Joan, which, according to legend, a woman, Pope Joan, reigned as pope for 2 years during the Middle Ages. She was a papessa.
What?
That's what they called it.
For real?
Yeah. Well, according to legend.
Papessa?
Yeah.
Lots of legends to sort out from that era of church history.
Oh, the Middle Ages were weird.
The historicity of some of these things are like, iffy. Mm-hmm. But that's also what makes it fascinating. Okay, papessa. Cool.
Who else has played the Pope?
Jeremy Irons.
Oh, yes.
Played Pope Francis in the movie The Two Popes, which I loved. And Anthony Hopkins was Pope Benedict. Also, Jude Law.
Mm-hmm. The young Pope.
Played a different type of Pope. A sexy Pope.
I never saw that. It looked scandalous.
Yes.
All right. More Pope trivia.
So Pope Urban VI, who served from 1378 to 1389, complained he did not hear enough screaming when cardinals who had conspired against him were tortured. So he got the cardinals tortured and he was like, more screaming, please.
Pope John XII, who was head of the Catholic Church from 955 to 964, gave land to a mistress, murdered several people, and was killed by a man who caught him in bed with his wife.
Whoa. Okay. Maybe this is why they did the whole celibacy thing, you know?
Yeah.
Similarly, Pope Alexander VI, who was pope from 1492 until his death in 1503, fathered at least 4 children, but maybe 9 from at least 2 mistresses. Again, celibacy requirement perhaps arose from a particular circumstances.
Not everybody seemed to follow it.
No.
Here's another one, another mistress one. Pope John X, the first pope to lead an army into battle, was deposed, imprisoned in the castle, and killed off in 974 by his mistress, whose name I will not attempt to pronounce. She was apparently more powerful than the pope. She was also the mistress of the previous pope.
Whoa.
Who also killed his predecessor. And then she put her son on the papal throne after that. Named him Pope John the 11th.
We need a Netflix miniseries about this woman.
I know.
Seriously. This is like, wow. The Pope's clothes are all made by local Italian tailors and cobblers. Mm-hmm. Gamarelli is the official tailor of the Pope. The Gamarelli shop was created in 1798 and has tailored for all the popes since then. It has been run by the same family for 6 generations.
Do they make puffy coats for popes?
Is that a thing?
No, the AI, the generated AI image of Pope Francis in the white puffy coat, remember?
No.
Okay. I'm going to let you Google that. Well, I tell you another Pope trivia fact that I think is crazy from the Middle Ages. Pope Stephen VI, who was elected in 896, exhumed the body of the previous pope.
Uh-oh.
And put it on trial. He dressed up the dead body, asked it a bunch of questions, which obviously went unanswered. Then he took off the fingers of the pope and ultimately threw the body into the Tiber, I guess.
So this was like the ultimate beef.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like when you're digging up the body of your nemesis and removing his fingers, like maybe go to therapy first. Mm.
Well, that might have helped a lot of these guys.
All right. And as for our current Pope, Pope Francis, our guest today, Claire, gave us a few fun facts. So Pope Francis used to tango. Mm-hmm. He was a bouncer. I have so many follow-up questions. Uh-huh. He loves empanadas. And he will sip any mate he is offered. Ooh. He was in love before taking his orders.
I did not know that.
That led him to question his vocation to the priesthood. He has changed the fashion standards among prelates who now opt for plain vestments and simple wooden or iron crosses instead of lavish jewelry or velvets.
Wonder how that tailor feels about it.
We liked it better when you all wore velvet. That was more fun. All right, a lot of spicy popes.
Mm-hmm.
But we should hear more about the very spicy synod and synodality.
Let's do it.
But first, a shout out for our sponsors who make this all possible.
Religion News Service is an independent, award-winning source of global reporting on religion, spirituality, culture, and ethics.
From Rome to Mecca to New York City, RNS is the go-to destination for the world's best religion coverage.
And be sure to check out Religion News Service's other podcast offerings. We've got Martini Judaism with Rabbi Jeffrey Salkin and The State of Belief with Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. And brand new this week, Money Meets Meaning, exploring the intersection of faith and finance. Give them a listen.
Roxy, we got a lovely email from a new listener this week. Edward writes that he recently began listening to Saved by the City. He really liked the Evangelical Bro Code episode. He said, "One of the things I appreciate about the conversations you have on the podcast is that you are both so smart."
Aww.
Say more. The conversations are almost always, almost.
I know, I love the almost in there.
Fair. We hear you, Edward. You're right. The conversations are almost always winsome, witty, wonderfully engaging. There is a cosmopolitan vibe that reminds me of why I so enjoyed living on the East Coast too many years ago. Aw.
Thank you, Edward. Be like Edward, everybody. Send us your feedback at sbtcpodcast@religionnews.com or drop us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you.
Hey there, curious minds.
Get ready to embark on a unique journey at the crossroads of money and religion with our new podcast, Money Meet Meaning.
The seductive effect of money, we think it can do the work that God does because there's something about money that does that. It's wild.
I'm Amber Hacker.
And I'm Tom Levinson.
Tune in for a blend of wisdom and levity as we decode the path to a more meaningful relationship with money.
I think giving, and this is a little crass, but I feel like it's the ultimate middle finger to money. It's liberating to give some away.
This podcast is your gateway to a vibrant and thought-provoking exploration of the interconnectedness of wealth and spirituality.
Join us as we unravel the surprising influence of ancient wisdom on modern finances.
Faith pervades people's lives and our society. And because money is such an important part of people's lives, exploring that intersection of faith and money, I think is super, super interesting.
Get ready to be informed, entertained, and inspired to transform your financial outlook with Money Meet Meaning. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
We're delighted to be joined today by Claire Jean-Gravet, who is a reporter with Religion News Service coming to us all the way from the Vatican.
Hey, Claire.
I'm super excited to be here.
All right. Well, we're going to cut to the chase. Is Pope Francis going to ordain women?
Oh my gosh. I get that question about a million times. I think the answer, to be frankly honest, is no. it's not going to happen. And I know that a lot of people that I talk to, some of my sources are going to be upset when they hear me say this, but the Pope has been pretty explicit about it. He's not going to go against his predecessor, John Paul II, who was pretty much clear, nope, not happening, get over it. Now, does this mean that there isn't going to be some sort of option for women? Something else that is out of the priesthood? I mean, who knows? But I wouldn't get too hopeful. And maybe that's just the general idea. You know, if you want to be a woman in the church, just kind of accept things as they trickle down slowly, and incremental steps is the way to go. And that seems to be Pope Francis's view also.
So when you talk about women's ordination, and you're saying it's probably not going to happen, you're talking about the ordination of women to the priesthood. Are we also talking about women as deacons, or is that what is also being debated currently?
There is a window open towards women deacons, but here's the thing. Pope Francis has created two commissions on this. And there is a saying at the Vatican, if you want something to be handled by the next pope, make a commission. And the pope has made two.
Okay. So a commission is kicking the can down the road.
This is the first that I'm hearing about the synod on synodality, because I grew up Protestant and I have not crossed the Tiber. But talk a little bit about the significance of the synod. Is this new or different for Pope Francis? Is this something that happens every year, or is this a special kind of one-time occurrence?
Synods have been happening in the church since forever. There are churches that do regular synods. And under John Paul II, there were synods. A lot of bishops would come to Rome. There would be some excitement. But at the end of the day, those synods were essentially a way for the Pope to say, I've got this thing I want to say. Let me talk to my guys first. They would complain that the result was pre-written normally. Mm-hmm. John Paul II said, I want to do this, but first I got to do a synod so I can say it with the whole backing of the church behind me.
As a formality.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. Pope Francis complained about that because he took part in some of those synods. He was there. And so he saw that they could be, kind of guided, and he felt worthless and not heard during those events. And that stuck to him. And he thought, what if synods were actually something different? Here's the thing. For us Americans, we like to see things kind of bring results. So we do something big, we start this massive consultation, and that's what the Pope did. He said, it's not going to be just about bishops. It's going to be everyone in the Catholic Church. We're going to try and get to 1.3 billion Catholics all over the globe. And he tried. He tried his best. The churches that wouldn't answer him or do as he said, he was like, do it. And they did. A lot of people responded. They went online. They tried to grab everyone. And they did. And they brought their problems forward. They had documents that were sent to bishops' conferences that were sent to the higher level and continental conferences, and then back to the Vatican, back and forth. And they met in October. What was the result? A report. And this report is a long list of grievances that I'm sure you've heard, if you have a chance to talk to any Catholic, complain about. Well, my church doesn't really give visibility to women. Or my son, who is gay, left the church because he didn't feel accepted. Or, you know what? The liturgy is boring. I don't want to go to mass. all these things that are just part of like everyday life. And these things came out. So this is what the Pope has done. Is it historic? Yes. Is it a new kind of synod? Yes. And the more he did it, the more he opened the doors to new and new people to participate. So he allowed women in, which is our topic today. And it's a big deal. If you think about the Vatican as a men's club, that was the man's club to talk about church affairs. So this thing that he's doing is really revolutionary in that sense. Mm. But it's not an organism or body that was created to make decisions. Mm. It's not a democratic body. There is a vote at the end, but the vote is just to get a general consensus. I've come to this conclusion now after being hopeful and then disappointed and then hopeful again, going through the roller coaster of the synod in these 3 years that it's been happening, is that it has become a listening chamber for the Pope. Mm-hmm. And so what it really does is that it serves as a kind of like a shell that the Pope can use to kind of listen to the movements of, he would say the Holy Spirit, but like the church and what they're concerned about. So this is what is happening. And the Pope's plan, because this is his brainchild, this is in a way the culmination of what this pontificate is about. He wants this to continue and be a part of the church, that there's no way that the Vatican can be once again completely segregated and separated from what is actually happening in the living flesh of the church. The fact that women came out and, in my understanding, were probably one of the most demanding, the most consistent, the strongest voices during the synod and had the backing of powerful prelates, that was strong.
Tell us more about that. So this synod on synodality, it's been going on for 3 years. It's been gathering feedback from Catholics at every level of the church. And what you just said is, like, women have been a huge voice in that. They've come forward in droves to give their feedback. So what are some of the primary reasons that women, Catholics, but also men, have been giving for why women should have a larger role in the church, even potentially and up to, like, ordination in the diaconate or ultimately priesthood?
So there's a million reasons, depending where they're coming from. We'll say things like, you know, it's high time for women to be heard. Some people will take the theological view. They'll say women were so central to Jesus's life that that is not reflected in the church today. Some other women will just take the practical road and say, we're already doing everything. Why aren't you letting us have a seat at the table? There are also some women who are talking just about power dynamics within the church, and they're pointing out to some of its flaws. Let's talk about, for example, sex abuse or the way the church handles certain issues that are close to women's hearts in a way that is sometimes completely estranged. These are the motivations, but there's really one motivation behind it that matters to the men in charge. And that is that people are leaving the church. In the West, people are leaving the church. We don't have official data on this, but every time some little groups tries to get a sense, women are the majority of that.
Of the people leaving?
And they used to be the backbones of the church. They used to be in the parish doing the hard work, getting people in. In Italy, when I think about church, I think about a ton of old ladies just kind of handling things and doing stuff and ordering the priest around.
The neck that turns the head, sometimes very aggressively.
Sometimes it needs to be turned a little aggressively.
Touché.
You know, they are leaving the church, and that is something that forces the Vatican and popes to address that. And one thing to say, well, okay, we lost maybe the generation of the 60s. That's tough, right? You know, predictable, but we lost them. The older generations, they're dying out. Okay, that's happening, and it's part of life. But the young generations are just not buying it. They see a world that is filled with opportunity for them, a place where they can have a voice more and more and more. And the church, by contrast, is becoming just not hospitable to that. And in the West, that's even more strongly felt.
You outlined some of the reasons that people are offering for why women should have a greater presence in the church, should potentially be ordained as deacons. What are the responses of their critics? What are the main reasons that Catholic leaders give for opposing women's ordination?
Normally they fall into, let's say, two categories. There's one guy, and by the way, they could also be women, who say, but don't you see that women in the Catholic Church already have so much? Is it just that women want more power? Why do you want to be a priest? You could be something else. You could be undersecretary of the Vatican Department on what and what. And there are so many things that are now open to you. Look at parish councils. Women are leading parish councils. Why are women so greedy for power? This is just those mean feminists who are trying to have it all, and they just want to take things away, and they can't be content. So that's one argument you get.
I think I know this guy. Yeah. Name and face came to mind.
I'm so glad I was able to bring a vision of what that guy's like.
I should say his evangelical counterpart.
Yes.
Of which there are many.
Yeah, it's definitely a type. So you get that. Then there's others who will take the intellectual, theological route. They will say, listen, Jesus was a guy. And he and his guy friends went around and did cool things. And he wasn't a woman. And there's meaning behind that. Mm-hmm. And when we think about priests and their role in the church, the priest is the husband, the church is the wife. It's very gendered. Mm-hmm. You're going against something that has been given to us by God. And you need to come up mm-hmm. with a stronger theological argument to combat that. Mm-hmm. So that's, I would say, really the heart of it, where the real mm-hmm. debate is happening. Mm-hmm. It's in that realm amongst theologians and canon lawyers. But thankfully, they are really amazing, smart, strong-willed, well-spoken female theologians. And they are bringing up the backbone of this position for saying, listen, Jesus may have been a man, but his first miracle he did because his mom told him to do it. And in going through that and then having that conversation, by the way, there's even a larger number of young women who are going in theology and really taking that battle head on. And then there's another guy, and that guy's just scared. You know, he entered seminary when he was 11, and he's never seen a girl in his life except his mom. And he looks at the Virgin Mary like his mom, and he thinks about women in abstract terms. He will use words like feminine genius. He will use words like complementarity. You know, you can see that those people, they're just frightened about what their church that they've known since they were children, that they grew up with, would look like if women were a part of it. Mm-hmm. That's a whole other bag of beans. Mm-hmm. But, you know, fortunately, also a generational one, in my experience. Mm. Women today have to sort of face that and address it. But again, I want to bring, you know, not just negativity to this. I've spoken to some women who are now dean of Catholic schools or even seminaries or schools that are just for missionaries. And they told me, when I sit in front of that desk, in front of a room filled with African priests, and I tell them about the gospel and I explain theology to them, they come up to me after class and they say, it's the first time I've seen a woman talk to me like that about God and Jesus. It was great. So at the grassroots level, that's already happening, and it's going to continue to happen more and more with those women who choose to stick around.
You wrote an interesting piece recently about the ways that feminism and Catholicism interact when they play nicely together and when they don't. Yes. How have some of the recent political realities in the U.S. and really around the world affected that relationship? I'm thinking of like the Me Too movement and the Church Too movement, as well as the Catholic Church's stance on abortion and even the Vatican's recent like denouncement of in vitro fertilization and surrogacy. How have those types of conversations affected the relationship between feminism and Catholicism?
So yeah, I had this great talk with Julie Rubio, again, one of the theologians I'd put in the line of these women who are just leading the charge unafraid and with the knowledge to back it. It was a fascinating conversation. And what she said essentially is that being a feminist by today's terms and being a Catholic at the same time is harder than ever. And the way she explained it is because the Catholic Church, which is already slow, as I mentioned, it has fallen even more behind in this time of great kind of societal changes in terms of understanding roles in the family, roles between men and women, roles, just your own sexual identities. You could also add xenophobia and racism in this, but I would say that the church has sort of tried to grapple that in a way that is consistent with today's demands. But really, she said that the church just is falling behind, and it's making it harder. The excuses that women would once use to stay within the church, which were things like, I've got to stay because the church needs my voice. I've got to stay because I am going to help my church no matter what go forward. This kind of argument is just getting weaker as time moves forward. The church is not going to change its position on certain issues that they would call the life issues.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And definitely they're not going to do that until women inside the institution have a chance to bring a perspective that can somehow soften it So that's just a reality that I think any woman who considers herself a feminist and wants to be a Catholic has to come to terms with. We're probably going to get a document at the Vatican that says that, you know, the gender you were assigned at birth is the gender that you have, and that's it. That, you know, is pretty obvious about being trans and takes a strong position probably against that, even though some things have been happening. This is a difficult topic, and I think it's one that really is going to hit the younger generations. They're going to have a tough choice to make if they're going to want to stay in the Catholic Church, because they're going to have to understand that they are within an institution that has a certain view of life that is maybe completely opposed to the way society today, and especially in the West, is looking at this question. One of the things that I thought, though, was really interesting about my conversation with her was that, you know, you think about these questions as being the main problems, but these are not the real problems for her. The real problems for her were with the liturgy. And that is that when you sit down at Mass, there are all these women, they're in the pews and they're just listening. And you know that there's all this talent surrounding you that is just being unused. You don't have to be a theologian to know that that is not the Christian way of looking at things. The Christian faith from the very beginning has been very avant-garde. The idea that there is no difference between men and women, that there's no difference between black or white or between old and young, really is deeply entrenched in Christianity. That went against the societal norms at the time when it was emerging. There was a time when the church wasn't acting 1,000 years late. It was 1,000 years forward. And for the women who are, you know, wishing to stick with it, it's worthwhile to think, listen, you know, that the church could be that again. They just need to get their act together a little bit.
You've kind of made a reference a couple times to positions of influence, power even, that women have had in the Vatican. And that's something that has grown quite a bit under Francis, right? Like there have been a lot more women appointed into positions that are not priest positions or ordained positions, but have a lot of influence. Has that been kind of part of his plan and part of sort of the change that maybe has happened at the Vatican around women during his papacy?
Yeah. The Pope has brought a ton of women in the church. A lot of amazing ladies, a lot of amazing religious sisters who are in there, who are hanging out, you know, eating lunch with all these guys, and they have their WhatsApp chats and their groups and activities. I mean, that is it's definitely going to be a transformative reality within the institution, and especially for those priests or those curial members who are not so used to having women walking through the halls. That's definitely going to have a lasting impact. But I do have a criticism on this. In general, the Vatican, and this is not just with women, it's with men and women. The Vatican likes people who are not troublemakers. They tend to like to have people on the inside who are good at keeping the party line. I've had so many interactions with some of these women who hold incredible positions that have always been held by priests, always been held by men before them. And maybe the only way to understand that is looking back at the feminist movement in our society outside of the church and just look at those first women who stepped in and who kind of thought that the best way to get ahead was to work twice as hard, but also kind of play along with the guys. Don't lift your head too much. Don't make a big fuss out of being a woman. Don't get too much in their faces about the jokes that are made or the comments that are made that it might be a little, you know, might be crass. Imagine the equivalent inside the Vatican. There's, I mean, probably crass jokes. I mean, I've heard a few. But at the same time, you know, just certain way of looking at women that just might not be great. And I would say that that's the situation the Vatican is in right now. We have that generation of women in there right now. And here's my concern. Is the Vatican, is the Roman Curia going to open its doors to the women who are a bit more into causing a little stir? The ones who are going to say, you know what? I don't really like being called the strawberry on the cake
right,
as a female theologian. I don't really like this term of feminine genius because, you know, it makes me think you've probably never met a woman in your life. And let's talk about that. Or, you know what, this position that you're taking on this issue or that at the Council of Cardinals that the Pope meets with every couple of months. Hey, you know what? I really think we should talk about some of the questions that are important to women right now. And I'm not going to just play along. Now, until the Vatican opens the door to that kind of women, I think it's going to be a long road. And I'm not trying to pull away from the fantastic stuff that is already happening. But it's a reality that I observe from the outside.
What is that? Second wave feminism? We're in the second wave feminist era of the Vatican. 1980s.
Maybe that's what's going to happen. I mean, that's going to make them all tremble in their skirts. I mean, that's probably their greatest fear in the world. But, you know, I mean, again, some middle ground. But there, again, I mentioned before, there are some women theologians who are just really cool, who get it, who are with the message, who love this church and this institution, who love the papacy, who think that the Catholic Church is the greatest thing since butter on bread, and they want to fight for it, and they want to have the tough conversations that I'm not so sure that some people inside the Vatican are ready to have.
I feel like maybe the Catholic Church predates butter on bread.
It does.
I just realized this is a bad Italian stereotype. Olive oil on panna.
On panna.
Yeah.
You know what's the greatest American invention when I went to, like, what's that? Is it Garden something? Olive Garden? Is there a place like that in the U.S.?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Please tell us as an Italian your thoughts on Olive Garden.
Okay. So the coolest thing ever about Italian restaurants in the United States is when they bring you those hot buns.
The breadsticks.
And then just like this, just the dip of oil. And you can dip the hot bread in the oil. Like you would never see that in Italy.
I thought that was authentic.
No, no. It's like, it's considered like quasi-nasty in Italy. But if you, they just love that. It's the coolest invention ever. And I feel kind of jealous that Italians didn't come up with that. Because, I mean, are you kidding? It's so delicious. And that by the time the food comes, you've eaten so many of those hot rolls that you're like, I'm not even hungry anymore. But normally that's what I do. When I go to Olive Garden, I just like go to town on the hot rolls.
I have not thought about Olive Garden for years. Yes. And now I'm like, I should go get dinner at Olive Garden tonight. Like you planted a seed.
It's brilliant.
Endless breadsticks.
I would say that's probably one of the greatest contributions to the United States ever. To Italian culture.
Yeah, right.
It's like Disneyland Tuscany. I'm trying to bring it back here, and I'm not convincing a lot of folks, but I'm also a big supporter of American coffee. I think it's superior. And when I say that to Italians, they want to take my Italian passport and rip it to shreds and disown me. But American coffee, I mean, come on. It's delicious. And nothing wakes you up like American coffee.
We got stuff to do.
I got to agree. Yeah, I know.
Sure.
You made it clear off the bat that Pope Francis is not going to ordain women.
A lot of people are going to get mad at me for that. I don't.
But he's made this space for listening to women. So tell us a little bit about Francis's legacy, what you believe it will be when it comes to women's role in the church and in church leadership.
Well, it's hard to talk about his legacy when it isn't, you know, his chance to build it isn't over yet. But it's not sexy. it's about starting processes, right? Again, another yawn. But if we're going to look, I think, at Pope Francis's pontificate along the line, and we look back at what he did, he allowed and created these spaces that are probably not going to go away. Hopefully that will be enough. And it will be really hard to go back from that. So when maybe 100 years from now, we're going to look back and women are going to be ordained as priests doing who knows what, or being pope, they might look at this pontificate and say, that's where it started. That's when the door was opened. And maybe that's the legacy that he's going to leave. It's just really hard to tell right now.
Yeah, I didn't mean to put you in the position of a seer, but you know, you understand these things. You have a pretty good sense of what's going on the ground, literally.
Well, I mean, the truth is women, I don't think, are going to give up on this. And mm-hmm. I don't know until how long the church will wait to do something on this. But there will come a point where the excuses and the explanation won't be enough. And maybe the Vatican is just buying its time and saying, let's see how other people do it. Let's take it slowly. That tends to be the approach. And hey, it's lasted 2,000 years. And, you know, so far, so good. You know, doing things slowly but surely.
Thank you so much for joining us for a really interesting conversation, Claire.
This was fun. So, Caitlin, do we have any Protestant takeaways from this conversation on women and synodality within Catholicism?
Yeah, I think it's kind of refreshing to know that Christian women from across traditions are wanting more acknowledged kind of formal leadership. I mean, we've talked about this before, that in a lot of churches, women are kind of running the show behind the scenes. Like, they're already in positions of leadership. They're already in positions of decision-making and making sure things happen. And they simply want to be formally acknowledged by the church. And there's this real resistance. And I know that there are specific Catholic teachings around who can administer the sacraments, and Jesus is a guy, was a guy. Jesus is still a guy.
Yeah, I think it's hard to imagine like the Catholic Church ever ordaining women. I just didn't even know that could ever be on the table. And maybe it really never will be, but I don't know. It seems like an opening. When I think about the whole process of synodality, I am impressed. I heard recently somebody refer to it as like the largest convening of an institution like in history globally. I think that's really impressive and admirable to like really want to hear from people at every level of the church in an institution that I, you know, we did all those Pope facts about like the Middle Ages and the popes, and like there's been a lot of scandal, a lot of not so praiseworthy moments within the Catholic Church and the papacy, from like the Crusades to popes having mistresses and exhuming each other. So I think the idea that the Pope would want to hear and would be interested in hearing from lay Catholics on these issues and would put on such a global effort to do so.
Right.
I think is great. And I don't know what the Protestant takeaway is from that, since we don't have that kind of like institutional structure, but I think the posture of listening is a valuable takeaway.
Yeah, it's especially impressive when you consider there are almost 1.4 billion Catholics all over the world. Like, by comparison, you're thinking about a Protestant denomination that might have a few million members. You know, I think the SBC is around 15 million. That is a lot of people, but then you span out into the global landscape, like 1.4 billion people. You're ostensibly trying to make sure that a lot of those lay Catholics are really heard and have a chance to shape the future of the church. So it's a huge undertaking, and it's going to be messy and imperfect, but the act of listening itself and allowing lay Catholics to feel like they actually have a voice in their own church tradition is valuable in and of itself, even if it doesn't lead to changes in the next few years. You know, the changes that people are asking for now are just planting seeds that in 100 years will come to fruition. Like, who's to say? I mean, the story of the Catholic Church is very long and slow moving. Change takes time. And I think, I wonder if Americans in particular are like, we're an impatient people. We want things to move quickly than this, you know, centuries old institution can.
Yeah. And I mean, for, you know, it's hard to invest in something that you think won't happen in your own lifetime. So if you're a woman who's looking for women to be in leadership in the church, and to know that like whatever you're doing right now toward that end, you're probably not going to be the beneficiary of that in your lifetime.
Yeah, it's kind of like Moses and the Promised Land. Like, he wasn't alive to see it, right?
He like got to look out on it off a cliff or something.
But then you think about the fact that there were so many women at the synod talking about some form of ordination for women. Like 100 years ago, I imagine that would have been unthinkable.
It reminds me a little bit of social media, like the conversation we've had about social media being like this democratizing tool where everybody's voice gets to be heard, people whose voices never would have been heard before. Mm-hmm. But it also means that you open a lot of cans of worms when you do that.
It's a double-edged sword, mm-hmm. this whole democratizing thing, because then you do hear from everybody.
Yes. Yes. And I think people in positions of power who are used to making decisions that just get obeyed or that they don't hear the backlash from, like, it's a little scary to be, I'm sure, to sort of have to be in a room with a lot of people who are not happy.
Yeah. It could be really easy to never let that happen.
Exactly.
Like, this makes my life so much more stressful and messy.
Yeah.
So we can talk about this more over drinks in Pittsburgh.
That's right.
Well, we will be in Pittsburgh by the time this episode comes out.
That's right. When this episode comes out, we will be together with Claire also.
Oh, Claire's coming. Yes, yay.
In Pittsburgh at the Religion News Association Conference. We'll be hanging out with all the religion nerds and getting the scoop from the religion journalists, which we hope to have a few snippets of that for you listeners next week.
Yes, we hope to share some snippets from this gathering of religion nerds with you all and hope that you find them as interesting as we do. And Roxy, it was great to see you in the future.
I'm sure we're having fun.
Undoubtedly, especially if we're talking about exhumed popes.
Yeah, and the synod on synodality. Saved by the City is a Religion News Service production. Senior producer is Jay Woodward, and the consulting editor is Paul O'Donnell. Our editor is Julia Windham.
Chaz Rousseau put together our look, and Martin Fowler wrote our theme music.
We are Roxy Stone.
And Caitlin Beatty.
Thanks for listening.